Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. Well, good day and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz and it is November. We're in mid-November, about the 12th and 13th, I guess, here. And this is episode number 187. We have lots to talk about today. What happened during the week? What do we expect for next week and into Thanksgiving? And we have a great guest. We have with us today, we're going to get in touch with very shortly, is going to be somebody who talks about tech very well, and somebody I think that you'll be very interested in hearing. You've heard him before. Eric Savitz from Barron's will be with us. In the meantime, how are you? How's it going out there? How's things been? Markets have been extremely volatile. We're going to talk about why some of that is and what you can do about that. We're going to talk about some of the issues related to our President Obama's movement around the world. And we're also going to talk about some of the issues that are right now dealing with QE2, IPOs, and what's happening with that interesting story about Disney last week. I thought that was kind of a very interesting situation. Maybe we'll start with that. You know, you remember, it was last Thursday, a couple days ago, that we saw that Disney came out with their earnings, posted it on their website at about 3:30 in the afternoon. Stock dropped off about 4.5%. And start to climb back slowly but surely. What happened was that inadvertently, somebody put the press release on the website. Now you say, well, okay. Usually they have a hold on that. They could say that they don't want to utilize or produce that or allow it out until a certain time. But for whatever reason, how it happened, I guess people found out how Disney used their naming mechanism in order to put it on the web. So they knew, let's say, that the third quarter, as an example, third quarter 2009, fourth quarter 2009, first quarter 2010, et cetera. They knew the naming conventions they used in order to actually put it on the web. And I guess Disney didn't figure that anybody could figure that out. I don't know why. Anyway, so they wouldn't put the link live until the right time. But unfortunately, some people figured that out. And what they did find was something they didn't like. They didn't like some of the headline numbers, et cetera, but they didn't dig deep enough. In fact, those people that got that information early and sold on that news lost about 4.5%. The next day it opened and it climbed higher on a better outlook. And that outlook that they had talked about in the conference call, et cetera, did them a justice and actually moved the stock up about 4% or so in a pretty awful tape on Friday. But leave it to the folks that are trying to get ahead of other people and trade ahead of them and figure out what they're doing. And it wasn't their fault. They didn't do anything illegal. They just looked at the information from where it was coming from. It was Disney's fault, frankly. It was an error on their part. But I think that was kind of interesting, a little bit of interesting fun that we see every once in a while, something coming across like that. Let's go back and talk about some of the things that recently happened last week. And I think that what we saw was a very volatile week ahead of the first actual and official QE2, right? We saw that we were all waiting on how much actually will be spent. We knew the number, $600 billion plus another $250 that was told to us a few weeks back, but actually how much was actually going to be spent in light of some of the economic conditions that we had recently seen? Well, it actually was very disappointing. from the market standpoint, first of all, what happened on Friday, if you didn't notice what happened on Friday, was, first of all, markets around the world opened up seriously lower because there was a print of inflation about 4.4% in China, much higher than they had not only anticipated, but much higher than their target rate. And the call was that, oh, well, now they're going to have to raise rates. They're going to have to do something, maybe stop buying the commodities, driving prices up, et cetera, et cetera. So they put a chill down the Chinese market. And in China, the Shanghai closed down close to 6%, 6% in one day after the inflation number came out. And that really caused a problem throughout Asia, bled over into India, bled over into Europe somewhat, not as specific in Europe. And the futures in the U.S. were down dramatically. When they opened, they gapped down. And it was pretty much a trend day down for most of the day. Picked up, of course, a little bit towards the middle and end. And then, closed, but still off. Here's the thing. What happened was at 10:30, they were supposed to see the first official QE2 buy by the Fed. But there was an announcement prior to that. Now, this is, put in the backdrop what happened throughout the world, okay? We saw less than expected numbers throughout Europe. We've talked about this before, that Europe is going to see a slowdown, a significant slowdown. And we saw exactly that. We saw that the industrial production numbers, the GDP numbers, all the production numbers around the area were very poor. Ireland is starting to creep in once again into the discussion in a big way in terms of their ability to pay back debt and ability to go to market and actually get anybody to buy their bonds, except for maybe, you know, the special fund that was put together by the EU. We saw that last week that Ireland's credit default swaps, CDS spreads, were the highest in history and the highest range differential. The spread was the highest it is from the Bund, and I think if not historically, in a very long time. And on that, the euro came down. You remember the euro was at 142, almost going to 143. It came all the way down to about 135 on Thursday. I think it was Wednesday or Thursday. And it started to creep up a little bit on Friday. But then, again, to bring it back now to what happened, that the Fed had, first of all, a glitch in the system. Somehow, something happened. Over the news wires came that the Fed was going to postpone their buy of the first installment of the QE2. Now, people are like, wait a minute. Why? Is it because of the good numbers we've seen throughout the week, maybe on domestic manufacturing, maybe on some of the inflation numbers around the world? What's different? What's happening? What's going on? And, you know, what happened was it was nothing more than a simple, I don't know, glitch or something in the system that they had to postpone the actual move of monies and to buy the treasuries to 11:30 in the morning. Well, everybody was in a panic. I mean, investors went berserk. They thought that all of a sudden their quick fix drug of printing of money was not going to happen. And oh, my gosh, just sell the market off. We saw some big players. And, you know, in the area, like big players like in Apple and Baidu, the big names, IBM. We're not talking about the small caps necessarily. We're talking about the big names sell off dramatically. Now, that was very unfortunate because it really started a bit of a cascade when we saw a news item that Ken Huebner had reduced his Apple position down to about, I think, about 101,000 shares from about 1.2 million. Or so. That was third quarter. That was last quarter. It's an old information. Then Rodman and Renshaw came out with a note that said their channel checks, quote unquote channel checks, which means they're walking into stores and seeing what's happening, show that possibly there's going to be a disappointment in the sales of iPads. So many I things. iPhone, iPad, iTunes, I this. But the iPad is going to be possibly a bit of a disappointment. Now, that may be the case, but you got to admit that the iPhone is still selling like gangbusters, even in the face of competition. So we're not that worried, but I got to tell you something. There was some pretty significant selling going on in Apple towards the end of the week. But the most important issue to look at, I think, throughout last week what occurred was that there was immense volatility in a variety of areas. Let's start with the commodity market, you know, the commodity pits and what happened there. There were days that gold was up 1%, down 1%, down 3%, up 2%. You had the same thing with silver. Silver gapped down 7% one day, and that was because of two things. Number one, the dollar strengthened that day. But the second thing, more importantly, was that the regulators of commodities and of the exchanges mandated that there would be higher margin limits requirements, margin limit requirements in order to trade silver. So I think it went from 2,500 to 3,500 on the margin requirements. In other words, you no longer could leverage as much silver as you could before. Same thing happened in the cotton markets. Now, what they're trying to do is stop the excess margining and leveraging / speculating in these markets. We saw limit down days on Friday of corn and on sugar. And cotton has been moving all over the place. But yet, at the same time, once they imposed these stricter limitations on margin requirements, well, what happened was it actually brought down prices dramatically. So we have regulation on one side that is doing what it can to try to curb speculation or at least free markets, etc. On the other side, we have Bernanke and the gang printing money and moving things around. And what we have is, in the middle, this clash, this gigantic clash of circumstances where they're looking for excess money to actually prop up commodities, etc., which to a point look a little bit overdone. Look what happened with oil. Oil was hitting close to 88, dropped down about 3.5% by the end of the week, actually Thursday and Friday. And that was in the face of the dollar. In other words, the correlation coefficient, when you look at the dollars to oil and how they actually correlate. So the dollar down, oil up, dollar up, oil down. Same thing with gold, most of the commodities. That didn't really come into play. What happened last week was with oil that there was a conscious effort, I think, by investors to actually buy oil on the extremely strong inventory report, the DOE inventory report we got Wednesday morning. So what we're having is that we're seeing that China and emerging nations are really going after, they're really in the market to buy oil because they need it for, you know, driving and for heating and for whatever else is required. And what's happening is now you add that to the quantitative easing, so dollar down, oil up situation. And again, it creates in the middle this giant clash. The circumstance on this clash, though, is that both sides are moving together, so it created a bit of a rocket ship when it came to the pricing of oil. So, again, let's tie this all together in a neat package. What I have been so concerned about is one thing and one thing only. The government's involvement in markets. The government's involvement in free markets. Without them, of course, without the regulation, etc., there'd be a problem. So, okay, regulation aside, their involvement in trying to actually push pricing around, force investors into one instrument or another, which will eventually end up in the wrong place anyway, because what you're going to end up having is the money flowing into this printed money, if you will, this quantitative easing. You're going to have money actually flowing into hedge funds, speculators, etc., that are going to push things up until the point that it just blows out and busts out. When will that happen? I don't know. But what we're seeing is that you're seeing a general move to where commodities have been just pushed to the limits. Copper at a new high, cotton at a new high, oil moving higher and higher, and silver just breaking it out, although silver has been moving 4% up, 5% down on a couple of different occasions. So the less than desired amount that it was actually spent on the QE2 on Friday, which was probably about a few billion dollars short of what everybody expected there to be, spooked the markets. And that's unfortunate because, again, it's the government's involvement in markets that are either giving them this euphoric or this depressive mode at any given time. But what we did see was something that went against all, pretty much everybody's estimation of what would happen with quantitative easing. People wrote me and said, Andrew, you know, if we see this quantitative easing, what's going to happen with the long bond or the short bond, etc.? Now, in theory, what should have happened was that the long bond went down significantly. The price goes down because a lot of, price goes up and yield goes down. So there's a lot of pressure on buying the long bond, right? The government's coming in and buying it, and the yield goes down. Bonds prices and bonds yields work inversely. Bond price up, bond yield down, bond price down, bond yield up. But what happened was something much different. What happened was that the Fed decided they were going to purchase the mid-range of the yield curve, the 5 to 10 year range, let's call it, generally speaking. Now, all of a sudden, all these bets were made on the long end of the bond. And what do you think happened? The realization that the Fed is not going to be actually buying those, which, side note, scratch my head. What do you mean you're not buying those? I thought the whole idea here was to reduce down interest rates to make home mortgages more affordable and loans generally more affordable. So what are you doing? Yes, I realize that you're also trying to inflate certain assets to keep you with your inflation targets. And I do understand that your mandate of higher employment levels than you have now are important. But I don't understand how you're going to get that with what you're doing. Okay, put the note aside. So what happened was that we actually saw a tremendous bounce on the yields of the long bond, the 20 to 30 year. A lot of people invest in the ETF TLT, which is the 20 to 30 year long treasury. We actually went the other way. We actually shorted it through the double inverse TLT, if you will. It's called TBT. And that has been up probably close to, this was down as 31, 36, about 18% in the last few weeks, give or take. Because what's happened is the trade reversed. Everybody was trying to get ahead and book their money into longs in anticipation that the Fed was going to actually do a lot of work there, and they're not. Now, what also happened was there's always this collateral damage, right? Again, because the government is involved in markets, it's the 6 million pound gorilla coming to dinner. And what happened here was that companies like Walmart and IBM and a few other big boys issued bonds, long bonds recently, at very low interest rates. And people bought those and they were really going out and excited about buying those because they were safe from good companies and the best rate they could find at the time. Those bonds right now are sitting on probably 3 to 5% losses. So if a municipality or a pension plan or a investor or whoever it is, maybe a mutual fund, went out and actually picked up these long bonds at, 2%, 0.75%, I think was the Microsoft issue. IBM issued bonds as well, very low. They're sitting on losses because long rates came up. And now these are not as appealing as they were before. Big problem. Makes the issuer look really stupid. Makes the salesperson who is representing this and pushing this look really stupid. And rightfully so. Did anybody really believe that bond rates on the long term are going to stay at those levels for very long? Well, maybe they could have stayed for a while, but were they going lower? I mean, come on. A corporate bond less than 1%? Was it going lower than that? Oh, come on. No way. I don't think so. So when you look at these circumstances and these crowded trades, like the crowded euro trade, we're shorting the euro / European stocks. And our clients got a special piece of information about this on why we're doing it and the thesis behind it. We actually put a small excerpt on thedisciplinedinvestor.com if you want to read why that is also, and how we're doing it is through a variety of different ways. But basically, the European situation looks pretty dire. And again, hearkening back to the IRA situation, it's coming to fruition, and it's going to come in fits and spurts. There'll be rescues, there'll be panics, there'll be rescues, there'll be panics. It's going to go on and off, and it's going to create problems because, once again, governments are involved in free markets. Now, there are a few things happening over the next few weeks. We have, for example, next week is options expiration, right? Third Friday of the month. Every month, third Friday, options expiration. So I would anticipate that Wednesday and Thursday, probably Thursday more than Friday, could see some additional volume set up into the move into options expiration. And with the markets at the prices they are, you have to wonder how many players are actually short on the top end, about 1225 on the S&P 500, and want to keep it under there to make sure that they, you know, are in the money on the end. And we probably see some fighting going around the 1200 mark, because anytime you get to a real round number on the S&P or on stocks, that's where the fighting really picks up. The other thing is, guess what? Guess who's back in town? You guessed it, our favorite Congress people. They're back in town for what we're calling the lame duck Congress session. We do lame duck here, trying to do the Peking duck Congress session. But they're going to vote on taxes, supposedly. We've got like 50 days left till the end of the year. It has to be a vote on taxes. I mean, ooh, really? No kidding. Keep us in suspense. What are you going to do? Already there's been some discussion about compromises. Or is it going to be a $250,000 threshold, $500? Is it going to be a two-year extension? Is it going to be a two-year extension for all? Is it going to be permanent? Anybody under 250, are they going to receive a benefit and keeping the extension of what is exactly the tax rate now? But over 250, your tax rates will increase? Or is it just going to be that we're going to move everything out and kind of sweep it under the rug for a little while, and hopefully everything will turn out well in the next 2 years when that Congress / administration will have to vote on it? My bet is that they're probably going to raise the limit to about $500,000, give or take. Even though President Obama won't like that, the Republicans are going to be pretty pushy on this. Again, in terms of, I believe what they're going to at least let get passed through here. But it's all going to be temporary. I think they're going to really push this off until sometime in the future, because right now is no time to make any significant long-term absolute, because it could be repealed anyway, right? So I think that right now we're going to see the extension, but that needs to come very quickly, because a lot of other things, aside from just the income taxes, you have payroll tax issues, you have all sorts of different numbers that have to go in, and employers need to see that so they can actually program the systems to properly account for these when the new year starts. Not that much time left. They let this go. I think it was highly political, let's say that, to let it go till after the election. But I think it was rather reckless of them to do so, and disappointing from a standpoint that, we deserve better as Americans, and we deserve better as taxpayers to have a little bit of insight on what we're doing so we could do some proper planning. I don't think anybody could really argue with that, right? All right, let's talk about some IPO issues. I think this is really interesting. Have you seen the IPO market lately? We talked about this on DH Unplugged this week, and we actually entered into one called Noah. I'll talk about that in a second. But there's an amazing run going on some of these, like Soda, S-O-D-A. It's like a little company that makes carbonated water. You would never think that carbonation in water would be so exciting. But it wasn't as exciting until Jim Cramer got a hold of it and started to say it was the best company in the world because they're making carbonated water. I mean, woohoo! But you know what? We're about to see this one probably drop, but it did go up 50-60%. After it actually came public. Make My Trip, which is loosely we could say it's the Priceline.com for India, has been doing very well. And there's a lot of these IPOs out there right now that really have opened up well above their IPO and insider price and have really been tracking up nicely. It's good to see, because that's the sign of a healthy market. We can bring IPOs to market. They're absorbed and they actually move up post-IPO market versus just falling down and all the insiders getting out quickly. The one we looked at was Noah. Noah is a Chinese play on the affluent market. It's a financial company that deals with financial wealth management and asset management, financial planning. And this is a burgeoning class in China, this whole affluent area, with the need to have planning put in place for their finances. So Noah, N-O-A-H, is the symbol, is one that we've liked and we looked at. We'll see how this plays out. Right now, it's new. It's profitable for us right now, but we'll just have to see how that plays out. The other thing I want to mention, and we will get to some questions that you have written me. And by the way, GM is IPOing next week. We'll see how that plays. Retailers. Retailers are setting up for some price wars into the season, which is right around the corner of the season. We're in the season, I guess, right now. But the retailers are setting up for price wars, and the question that we all have is, how are these price wars going to play out? Already we've seen the inventory to sales ratio increasing. What does that mean? That means that inventories are growing at a pace that is faster than the merchandise is able to be sold, both on a business and on a wholesale basis. Now, one of the reasons could be, okay, retailers are expecting a very good holiday season and rightfully stocking up so they don't run out of anything. Okay, I can go there. The other thing that may be is that they're overestimating how much sales they're going to have because they've had a nice little run here. And what's going to happen is that they're not only going to have excess inventory, but, good for us, they'll be discounting significantly. Already we're hearing about things like electronics being discounted like crazy. Walmart's coming out with ridiculous pricing wars right now. And retailers in general all around are actually discounting significantly. And we saw that in the last retail sales number, that there is a big move to discount in order to bring in the consumer. And it's working because the volumes are higher, even though the prices are lower. But here's where the problem comes in. How much are they going to be able to discount when we know, because we just talked about it, that prices of input, cotton, any of the materials that go into maybe rubber, any kind of oil / petroleum product that goes into the manufacturing, if that's all going up, how are they going to discount and save their margins? Good question, right? So the margin issue is going to be on the table through the next quarter. We're going to be watching, investors are going to be watching margin slippage very carefully. We already saw, for example, some companies keeping a really good line on margin right now, but saying that in the future they're really concerned about this because input prices are increasing, and they're going to have to do what they can to cut expenses in other places, keep inventories lean, in order to make the numbers they want to make. Now, I guess we have to talk about the whole idea of outlook when we're talking about retailers' outlook and look at things like what happened with Cisco last week. What a disaster. Everything was fine with their current numbers. Generally fine. I shouldn't say fine. They were okay. Their outlook was miserable. This is not the first time that the outlook has been miserable from Cisco. As a matter of fact, I would share with you that if you look back on Cisco's earnings over the last several quarters and then look at the stock and then look at the markets right afterwards, there is a bit of a correlation in how Cisco has the outlook of Cisco and how the stock has dropped and then what's happened with the markets afterwards. John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, brilliant guy, great manager, has been kind of glum over the last few quarterly calls. And that has translated into a sell-off. Now, Cisco had the worst post-earnings sell-off it's ever had, down about 16% after they came out with the earnings. The expectation of growth of about 15 to 18% or so was only about 5% they said they're going to do. Their margins are going to be under pressure. They felt that their inventory was building. The book-to-bill ratio was under 1. There is a lot of problems with what they said, and you have to wonder what would pick this up. The big problem was in cable. And they also said that the bigger problem was in government spending. Municipalities and governments were really slowing down on spending. So is the stimulus money running out? Is the broadband plan, which we talked about at great length with Robert V. Green last week, not happening? Cisco's probably the center of the whole thing. There's something kind of weird about some of the companies in the universe that play alongside of Cisco, the F5s, the... the companies like I'm drawing a blank. That's not good. All right, we have in the cloud space, generally speaking, we have like an F5 Networks, Lam Research for some of the chips and some of the things that go into it. We have an APacket, Acme Packet, which does the concession controller boards. And, you know, again, you have some of Microsoft in a way, some of the hardware there, Intel in a bit, you know, kind of putting it together, some of that also. And, you have to say, what is the problem here? Well, again, set-top boxes. They bought the Scientific Atlanta. That's not doing well, etc. But I will tell you that I don't necessarily see the same kind of discussion from CEOs that we're seeing from John Chambers and the management of Cisco. So I don't know if they're seeing something different or if they're right on. I don't know. If other CEOs are being too optimistic or if it's maybe just their niche of what Cisco's doing and that's just getting hurt. We're going to have to see what happens with that. And finally, I want to discuss one thing before we get to Andrew Ross Sorkin and well, actually some questions we have from listeners. There was a great piece put out by JP Morgan this week that looked at correlations. Everybody's saying, hey, the markets correlate up, everything goes up or everything goes down. They looked at the correlation on the up and down days and found that the correlations of all asset classes, when things sell off, whether it's gold, oil, or commodities, and stocks and bonds, etc., are very much linked. So on down days, there's a big linkage in what's going on. In the up days, the correlation breaks. Not as you can't find the correlation as clearly as it's been before. Now, what does that mean? How do we decipher that? I think what we have to say is that in the down days, obviously there's some selling going on of ETFs and futures and things of that nature. But I think more so, this may be some protection buying, some hedging, because you want to get broad-based hedging. And if you're going to buy some either some futures on the downside, some puts, some negative inverse, if you will, of what the markets are, whatever market it is, and you're looking for some protection, I think you're going to get this broad-based view of what's happening across the board. And it's different because it's more of a stock-picking situation, individual stock picks, if you're actually in looking for positions that are on the up days. So I think that's where the differential comes in. And that's still healthy. We'll see how that plays out a little bit more. But that's still healthy. Because what you're seeing there is people looking for protection and protecting themselves rather than just doing broad-based sell-offs. But again, we'll see how that looks. And then usually what we find is that volume is down on individual positions with that in mind. All right, let's get a couple of emails that came in here. Let's see. This came in... And by the way, if you want to email me, it's askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. This was a couple of weeks ago. We had someone on that we were talking about. Let's see here. He was, I'm trying to find out who this is from. Okay, this is from Saunier Moving. I'd like to see a chart showing the rise in the stock market too and the correlation to election dates. I guess it had to do with when we had on Tom McClellan. Well, good news. That's on the Disciplined Investor website. We did all that already. Tom provided us that and showed how the election cycle works so nicely. And I thought that was kind of good that you did that because we did talk about that on that podcast. So go over to the Disciplined Investor and just type in the search for presidential cycle. This one's from George Rovney. He says, Andrew, I love the podcast. I've been a faithful listener for about 100 sessions or so. Good for you, George. I have a question. I've been interested in selling call options to hedge downside a bit. Hey, we just talked about that. But have held back because of uncertainty. I understand that if the equity increases in value above the strike price, I get my shares called away. But what if the prices fall precipitously? Am I required to hold sufficient shares to cover the option for the duration of the option? In other words, if I was stopped out, then the stock made an amazing comeback and hit the strike price, would I be debited the amount required to cover the call? Or would the brokerage prevent me from ever being stocked out because I required to hold it? Okay, so what you're talking about is covered calls. Covered calls. And here's the answer. Yes, for the most part, you are correct in what you're saying here. That above a certain point, you're going to have to give away your position. But basically, if there's a precipitous fall, what ends up happening is the call that you have will be worthless, right? So therefore, you still own the stock. So I'm not sure what you're talking about there, but you know, basically there's covered calls and then there's naked call selling. I'm not sure if you want to do naked call selling because you have unlimited risk there. But if you're looking to hedge your downside risk, the problem has to do with liquidity. Because if you do want to get out of the position, you have to actually sell or buy back the option and at the same time sell the stock. So I think what you need to look at is how much liquidity you need and realize that if the position moves against you, so you bought Apple and you bought 100 shares of Apple at 200 and you sold the call at, let's say, 220. Well, if the stock moves up past 220, they could take it from you or you just pay it out. On the other hand, if the stock moves to 180, well, the call's worthless. You get to keep the premium and you didn't have to keep the stock at that point. There was another question by Brian Parkinson. I thought this was interesting and maybe somebody else has some more information on this. He says he's enjoyed the podcast. And he wanted some thoughts on the following topic. He said, a few attorneys have formally proposed to the SEC that it makes a rule to change that could dramatically increase the capital available for investment in small local businesses. They request that the SEC permit businesses to raise up to $100,000 with a limit of $100 per investor without having to spend the hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal and accounting fees that would otherwise be necessary. What's really neat here is that a simple common sense rule could unleash a torrent of priority capital for local economic development, and at a time when traditional financing has become scarce. Well, all right, that's interesting, but why would anybody want to invest $100? I mean, what are you going to make on $100? Maybe I'm being a little bit too ridiculous about this, but you get 1,000 investors at $100 a piece. Wow, that's a lot of accounting that you're going to have to do and information you're going to have to provide. Either way, maybe you don't have to do the traditional public offering of sorts. But $100 an investor, if they double their money, they get $200. And that's great, but what is it going to take to get to that point? I mean, and if $100,000, what are you going to do with $100,000 as a small business? It's interesting, don't get me wrong. But if you have a limit of $100 per investor, I mean, I would think maybe $1,000 per investor would seem a little bit more logical. So I don't know. If anybody has any thoughts on this, there's a petition up, and there's something that you could find on, let's see, the SEC.gov site under petition 4-605. So check that out, see what you think. I don't know. Brian, it sounds interesting, and you know, in a world where everything is just perfect and all that, that's, oh boy, raising $100,000 is great, but I don't know about the practicality. Practicality seems a little bit far off of me. And we're going to plug right in now to, actually, the writer of, Eric, wasn't your old, didn't you used to be called Plugged In?
Wasn't it? Oh, well, that was years ago. So there's two tech columns at Barron's. There's Plugged In, which my colleague Mark Paverka now writes. I used to write years back, but now I've been writing a column called Tech Trader Daily,
right,
which is my blog, and then Technology Trader, which is the companion column in the print magazine.
Right. So this is Eric Savitz from Barron's, always the go-to guy when it comes to technology. He writes a daily blog, of course, called the Tech Trader Daily. Just look up Eric Savitz or Tech Trader on Google. You'll find him. And also writes a lot about in the Technology Week. But, you know, I guess it used to be – let me ask you a side question here. Did it used to be harder – or easier, or you know, to write when you didn't have to write every day on the internet and find every single story where you could just kind of, you know, now, you know, the old days you used to be able to just culminate everything in a once a week article, right?
Yeah, it's the difference is that obviously it's a lot more, a lot steadier if you're trying to produce kind of comprehensive coverage of all the major events going on in technology. But the advantage is that you stay pretty on top of everything that's going on, and so. My column in the magazine is kind of a culmination of a week's worth of reporting on the web. So it's hard work, but it's fun, and I enjoy it. So
yep, I hear you.
It's fun.
All right. Well, in this week, this is what you and I had wanted to talk to you about. What you actually wrote about in this week's Barron's on sale now, of course, is does Cisco's woes signal a broad tech downturn? Now, let me just kind of give everybody a little taste of what you wrote here. Basically, that first of all, which is interesting, that their current fiscal year ends July 2011, and the fiscal year forward that John Chambers talked about was the thing that shook people up. But what tell us a little bit about what your thoughts were on the current quarter and the current, you know, looking back the last few quarters comparatively, and then we'll kind of jump to the forward look.
Sure. So, well, the October quarter, Cisco, of course, is a month off. They reported their quarter ends in October, with everyone else just reported September quarters. Their October quarter was okay. I mean, mm-hmm. the revenue line was about in line with street estimates. The EPS line, they actually beat by a couple of pennies. And so, you know, based on those numbers alone, you'd think everything was, you know, fine. I mean, it wasn't a blowout quarter, but it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
But when the more you dig down to what happened in the quarter, the more concerns there were. And in particular, the reported numbers were okay, orders were soft.
Mm-hmm.
So on the conference call after they reported, one of the things that John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, mentioned was, that they their orders were about $500 million below their own internal forecasts. So that was part of the problem.
Right.
So they're seeing soft orders.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the court along those lines, he talked in more detail about where the problems lie. And he mentioned a number of areas. He said that orders from their public sector business, which is I think a little over 20% of their business comes from the public sector, or broadly described. So that's governments of all kinds. But in particular, they were seeing softness from U.S. state governments, from some European governments, and also from Japan. So that's one problem, weak spending from governments. Another problem they mentioned was that they were seeing some softness from their carrier segment, and in particular, sales of set-top boxes to U.S. cable companies. They have to remember that Cisco bought what used to be the old Scientific Atlanta cable box business, and that's basically been a duopoly. I mean, it's Cisco and Motorola. Motorola bought the old General Instrument.
And isn't Motorola trying to spin that off?
Motorola is in the process, of course, of
cutting
itself into two pieces, so one of which will include that that business, the other which will be focused on mobile phones. The other problem they were having is they said was that business in general from Europe, they mentioned Europe twice, basically, once on the government side, but that in general business from Europe was soft. So the question that then arises when you look at all of that is, at the end of the day, is this a Cisco problem, or is there something more more fundamental happening in the economy that Cisco is picking up on?
Well, Cisco, a couple of things. I could definitely understand European orders being slow, particularly the public sector. I get that, where there are austerity and they're not spending money and they're tightening the belts and they're not doing anything. Okay, got you there. Japan, all right, I'll go along with that. I have no problem with that. I don't get the whole U.S. government spending being lackluster, only because you would think that the U.S. spending has actually, it's supposed to be. As a matter of fact, we had somebody on that wrote a great piece about the broadband initiatives, that you would think that there should be the continuation of these public service projects and the infrastructure development of the broadband networks, which is the heart of what Cisco could really provide for the governments. But obviously, not the case.
So that may be true. However, the issue is really with state governments. The problem they've had is not so much with federal government spending, which is where some of the broadband stimulus money has basically been coming from, but with state governments. State governments are under pressure.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing it certainly here in California, where they're struggling as usual to try and find a way to balance the budget. And state governments across the country are finding it difficult to keep their budgets under control, and so are tightening their belts, and it's hitting their infrastructure spending.
So
at least that's what Cisco was saying.
So first of all, I thought balanced budget in California is taken care of with IOUs. Am I wrong about that?
California's budget is a mess.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's a subject for another call.
Yeah,
another
I hear you. So I sent you and I'm going to post this on this episode's show notes. I sent you a chart. I don't know what you make of it, but we posted and pinpointed the earnings announcements over the last couple of 3 years for Cisco, overlaying the actual price performance of the S&P 500. And it's a little bit, there's definitely a little trend there, don't you think?
Yeah, well, one of the things that, now I'm not a big technician, but I will tell you that from a fundamentalist point of view, one of the things about Cisco is if you go back to the November 2007 quarter,
mm-hmm.
Before the bubble blew up, when we were all feeling like everything was hunky-dory,
mm-hmm.
Cisco came along and told people, somewhat shockingly at the time, that it had begun to see softness in its enterprise IT business.
Mm-hmm.
The result was a fairly sharp sell-off in the market, much like we saw this week after Cisco reported. What turned out to be, frankly, an early warning, kind of canary in the coal mine, warning of what turned out to be one of the uglier economic downturns we've all suffered through. And so, because of that, and for a few other factors, which I can touch on, Cisco becomes kind of a bellwether. There's a couple other things that work here. So, as I noted, they are an October reporter, and they report pretty quickly after the end of the quarter. And so, in a way, they also give an early read on how the month of October has been, and if there have been any economic changes affecting corporate performance in October. And so the market is super sensitive to Cisco. Chambers also has a particular style where he provides huge amounts of detail about their business on their conference calls. They're like the longest earnings calls you'll ever hear. The last one this week went on for close to 2 hours.
Yep.
Very unusual for an earnings call. You need stamina to get through the whole thing. But the result is you get a lot of data points to sort of chew on. And because they have this habit of occasionally kind of blowing up the stock market, people are super sensitive to them, and I'm not surprised that you see points where the market seems to be moving on Cisco's numbers. Now,
yeah.
I think that the real question, and it's part of what I wrote about this week, is you have sort of two potential interpretations here, and I think the street is quite divided about the truth of the matter. Either Cisco is reflecting real trouble in the economy that we're just not picking up on yet in a broader way, or there are problems at Cisco that go beyond the economy and reflect a weakness in their own business, that these are Cisco problems. And so, for example, some of the analysts who cover the company argue that in addition to the issues that they raise, which we talked about earlier, there's some other fundamental weakness in Cisco's business, that they're losing some market share in their core router and switch market to companies like Juniper or HP, which of course bought 3Com not that long ago, or the Chinese manufacturers like Huawei. That's one possible interpretation, is that this is a Cisco problem and not necessarily reflective of larger, previously unappreciated forces.
Yeah, this reminds me of when the quote-unquote cloud computers sold off on the bad earnings pre-announcement. What was that? 2-3 months ago. Who was the company? It was who came out with that? There was a bad micro. No, not micro. Anyway, there was and then everybody sold off. F5
right.
sold off,
yeah.
And even like Salesforce sold everybody. And then the question is, at the end of the day, do you stick with the estimates that you heard, saw, and can look at as probable for companies, and just kind of wade your way through this, or is it going to be throw the baby in with the bathwater? That's the big question, I guess, that everybody's having here.
Right, absolutely, and I think there's, as I said, there's tremendous debate. I mean, if you read, Cisco's covered by dozens of analysts, and if you read some of the reports, you find a real split. I mean, there are some people who say this is not a Cisco problem specifically. I mean, it's a problem for Cisco, but it's not a Cisco specific problem. There's some underlying softness in parts of the economy. Now, the question is. One of the points I made, I really don't think that the areas that they talked about are huge surprises. I mean, so for example, if you take the weakness in their cable set-top box business, for example, there are a lot of reasons that shouldn't be surprising to people. Cable set-top box sales are tied in part to pretty directly to the market for housing, right?
Right.
So as you build, you buy a new house, you move in, you set up cable, you need a new cable box.
Sure.
It's also tied to sales of flat screen TV. So you junk your old TV, you buy a new flat screen TV. You go from standard cable to digital cable,
right.
And you need a high def capable box. You get a new box. Somebody sells a new cable box. So there's a number of factors that work here that would suggest trouble for set-top box sales. Housing numbers are still lousy. The consumer economy is still bad. There have been numbers month after month of weak sales of LCD televisions. Right. They've been down. They just posted something yesterday afternoon. LCD television sales have been down in the U.S. Year over year for the last 6 months in a row. So, so it's not surprising to see those numbers be soft. And frankly, you know, that's a set-top box business really only affects two companies. So, you know, that's a kind of a company specific situation, I think, there.
Yep.
You know, the state government thing, you know, I think that's real, but I'm not sure that that's entirely surprising. But, you know, so the question is whether there's more there or not. I mean, there's another set of analysts that say, as I said, that this is really Cisco struggling to grow. And, you know, the other thing to keep in mind about Cisco that I think is fascinating is they have very much stuck to their guns on a long-standing, long-term forecast that they can grow their revenue between 12 and 17% over the long run.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say they can do that every quarter, but on average, they think they can grow that fast. Now, that's a pretty aggressive position for a company. You know, you have to remember they're doing north of $40 billion a year in sales. So, you know, to do, you know, even 10% growth, you're, you know, say 15% growth on $40 billion, you're talking about creating an extra $6 billion a year in sales. That's not an easy thing to do. So,
sure.
You know,
sure. Well, especially when there's competition out there these days.
Yeah, and Cisco's have gone into new businesses. They're now making servers. They're doing, you know, telepresence. They've gone into a whole bunch of new businesses. But the question is, maybe that's just too aggressive for a company their size,
yeah.
And maybe they're making some. They're stretched into markets where they're not looking.
Yep. You know, one of the things that they did, and we'll finish on the Cisco, and I got two things to talk to you about, Apple, RIM, and I wanted to touch on Microsoft. They got to touch it. On Cisco, one of the things they did, and this has also been their growth strategy, is to do, as I see it, is do what they can to enhance and to expand the requirement for broadband. In other words, You do things like you buy the flip camera. And when they bought the flip camera, I was like, you know, what is that all about? You know, what is that? Sounds so wonky. But I was thinking, okay, you know, this is a video camera that's easy to, you know, utilize. It's small. You upload your video somewhere. And what is that going to mean? Well, at the end of the day, that means you need higher bandwidth, you know, more broadband. Where do you get that from? Well, back to Cisco. So that made sense when I thought of it that way. I don't know if that's really what happened,
yeah, I mean,
but that's,
you know,
what it seems to me.
Right. I mean, there's certainly, this is akin to Intel for years was investing in all kinds of companies that seemed to have nothing to do with Intel's business at all, but it was all about trying to drive microprocessor sales. And so it's kind of like that, right? So Cisco, if whatever you sell requires you to use more bandwidth, that's to Cisco's benefit.
Right.
And, you know, I think the other thing about the Pure Digital purchase, the flip cameras, is you know, they've always wanted to have more of a consumer facing you know, some aspect of their business that's more consumer facing, and that's part of that. And, you know, they bought Linksys, the modem company, as well a few years back,
they haven't rebranded either. But anyway, here's what I think, and I don't know if you cover this company. This is kind of an outside point, but if we're, you know, this whole expanding bandwidth, voice over IP, video over IP, et cetera, this company Acme Packet, you follow them?
Yeah, I know about Acme Packet.
It seems like, this is my opinion, the perfect fit if Cisco wants to grow in that area, if there is all this excess cash going around, the perfect fit for them to, you know, do a little buyout of these guys, if that's the trend these days. I don't know, we'll see. But Acme Packet's a solid company, and they sort of are in that business alongside of Cisco.
Well, you know, certainly, you know, I have no idea if Cisco has any interest in buying Acme Packet.
Right.
But what I can tell you is that, you know, Cisco still has plenty of cash. They're still, they will remain acquisitive. I mean, it's part of their strategy to get to that big growth number is to be out there looking for acquisitions.
Yep.
And they continue to shop for acquisitions. You know, and they are certainly very interested in video and the web. I mean, they've made some really astonishing projections on their rapid demand for bandwidth, and it's really as much as anything driven by video.
Yeah, we just did a piece, actually wrote about the presence in China and the video page growth in China, particularly focusing on Sina and a couple of the other companies out there. Boy, the numbers are, and Sohu, the numbers are really astonishing. Let's talk about Apple for a second. Kenneth Huebner comes up with a release that he sold all, about 90% of his Apple shares before the September 30th quarter, and everybody got a little spooked about that. But of course, he mentioned that he also bought some Priceline in place of it. But, you know, by my calculations, he sold it about 15 to 20% too early, right? Does that seem about right to you? If he sold it before September 30th?
Yeah, well, look, you know, Ken Huebner's a great fund manager, but, you know, people sell things and buy things for sometimes for reasons that are, I mean, you know, people sell Apple by the millions of shares every day, right? I mean, it's
right.
Just the nature of the stock market. I mean, I think that Apple stock certainly has had an impressive run, and I could see, I don't know what his cost basis it was in Apple, but, you know, if he was taking substantial profits, it's hard to argue with him about that. But I do think that Apple is still doing amazingly well. I mean, the iPhone really has changed the market for smartphones. In many ways, they've really reshaped the way we think about the mobile phone business. The iPad has been a remarkable success and is doing the same thing in tablet computers, where they're really, I mean, nobody owned a tablet computer before.
The Fujitsus that were out, everybody hated. Remember those, the Fujitsus that they tried and tried
There were a bunch of attempts to do this, and no one got any traction. Right. So that's been remarkably successful. The new Mac Air and notebooks are just an astonishing piece of engineering. They're beautiful computers, and they've made some very interesting decisions there. There's no hard drive in them, which they use only flash memory for storage.
Mm-hmm.
That makes them super fast, so they boot up almost instantly.
Yeah, there is no boot up. It's just on.
It's just on. Right. They're lightweight. They're beautiful, and I think they will sell incredibly well. I mean, Apple is really kind of firing on all cylinders right now. And so, you know, I think, Ken's a smart guy. I'm sure he has good reason to take profits. I don't see any reason to see Apple slowing down. Now, there were some, a little bit of worry on Friday around Apple's iPad sales. Rodman and Renshaw, Ashok Kumar came out and made some comments that sort of suggested he thought their sales might be softer than people think for iPads in the December quarter. I don't think he had a lot of hard evidence there, really.
Hold on a second. Ready? Channel checks.
Channel checks. Yeah.
Channel checks. You know what that is?
Channel checks means is basically some guy he happens to know in Taiwan who.
Right. A stroll through the mall in Milwaukee.
Yeah, well, that's possible too. but for whatever whatever it's worth, I don't know. I mean, I still think that iPad sales are fine, and I think, frankly, the other point that he makes, by the way, in that piece, is that sales of other tablets so far are not very impressive. You know, Dell's tablets, the new Samsung tablet.
Mm-hmm.
There's coming. It hasn't started selling yet, but we've got the new BlackBerry Playbook coming up soon. And his point is that it could be that there just isn't going to be a market for many of these other devices, and we'll see. I mean, I have an iPad,
mm-hmm.
and my daughter is using it to play video games in the other room at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I actually think the device is hugely valuable. I don't really see it as a replacement for my laptop, but I think that it has many many uses in various circumstances,
yep.
and I think a lot of people are going to want one. I think it's going to be a huge seller for.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a huge holiday gift as well, and we'll see how that plays out. Lenovo's even launching one now. You know, you talk about RIM for a second. Research in Motion. Research in Motion must have. It clearly has a cult following because they continue to disappoint and clearly lose market share, but the stock bottoms out and then starts running up into earnings and then just gets obliterated. And then does this about the last four or five times, I think, on earnings it's happened. And now the big thing is the carrot is the new playbook. And the playbook, it looks interesting, although it's a 7-inch, I think it's 7 inches. It's a little bit smaller. You know, we'll see how this works, but I don't know. I don't hold a lot of opportunity for it comparatively. I think it'll be a nice thing to look at, a great little thing to say, oh, how interesting. It's kind of like Sirius XM. You know, there's that groupies that just, you know,
yeah.
You know what I mean? RIM also. Motorola in a way, too, although I think people have lost that whole thing with Motorola.
Motorola's changed. And I think Motorola's now all about the split up of the company.
Right.
But let's talk about RIM. I mean, I think that there's a couple of things that are going on about RIM. The stock did have took a huge hit and has been rallying pretty impressively off the bottom. And I think a couple of things are at work. One, you know, the company still does have a pretty impressive position in the enterprise. I mean, there are still many companies who have a BlackBerry-only policy on smartphones, although what's happening in some places is some places are adopting a kind of bring-your-own approach on other types of phones. So, you know, we'll give you a BlackBerry, but if you want to use an iPhone or an Android phone, okay, but we're not going to pay for it.
Right.
We'll let you access your email, but mm-hmm. we're not going to help you. And so that's, you know, that kind of approach is kind of a it likely leads to some market share loss for BlackBerry, but probably slower than if somebody just said, you know, we're going to support, we're going to give our employees iPhones instead of BlackBerries. But there have been some instances of that. Some banks are doing that now. There have been some widespread reports about some banks that are going to replace.
Well, yeah, because they're using setting up iPhones. But I think both of those circumstances, I hate to sound like an Apple junkie right now, but both of those circumstances benefit Apple. I'll tell you why.
Yeah, that's true. Now, that's obviously true because, I mean, it gives you an opportunity to use your iPhone for work more than just...
And if you want to keep your BlackBerry, you'll get yourself an iPad.
Right, yeah, that's right. Now, a couple of other things about BlackBerry. One is that... one of the things the bulls talk about on BlackBerry is that they continue to have very high demand in some international markets,
right.
In places like there are markets in Latin America, for example, where it's hugely popular with young users who like the BlackBerry messaging feature.
Mm-hmm.
There are some of that those things that. You know, observers in the U.S. market are not necessarily experiencing firsthand, so the bulls will sometimes argue that, maybe there's some competitive issues in the U.S., but they're doing great in international markets. And then you've got the playbook, which is, as you say, it's a smaller device than the iPad. It has some other peculiarities. So. It's 3G capable, but if you want to use, it's Wi-Fi capable, but if you want to connect via 3G, you have to tether it to your BlackBerry. So that's a peculiar decision because it basically means that the only people who are going to buy a playbook are people who already have a BlackBerry. So you've kind of limited your audience some by taking that strategy. That is actually reminiscent of something that Palm once did. Some years ago, there was a device called the Palm Folio, which was basically not a tablet, but a little sort of netbook kind of thing that you could use to connect to the internet to get your email and things like that on mm-hmm. a device with a keyboard. And the problem with it was that the only way to get to the internet was to connect through your Palm device, and the thing never sold at all. So, I mean, by the design of the product. You've limited your audience to BlackBerry users. So, I don't know. I'm not seeing, I've not played with the device. People who've seen it seem to like it. It's based on a different operating system than the BlackBerry. This OS called QNX that they bought not that long ago. The problem with that is getting developer support. So, yeah, if you're going to buy a, a tablet, you want to make sure there are lots of applications. I mean, on the iPad, you've got lots of applications. You can run those iPhone applications and so on. So, you know, will they get enough developer support to make it worthwhile? I don't know. We'll see. I mean, it's a chicken and egg problem.
I don't know. You know, what happened with the Torch? What happened with the Torch? The Torch sold what? Its first day was like, what, 250,000 or something ridiculous?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Torch, you know, the Torch had an okay debut. I would say that there was expectations had gotten a little too high that the Torch was going to be some, you know, iPhone killer kind of product. And it was like an incrementally better BlackBerry, but it was, at the end of the day, it was pretty familiar looking. And it sold largely to BlackBerry users upgrading their phones and not taking market share from other players.
It's like a bite of a flea on an elephant, it seems to me.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, let's talk about and finish up with Microsoft. So much promise, so much great things coming out of them. Although Office 10 I just installed, and still a couple of things that I don't like. But you know, it upgrade, it's nice. It's a little more flashy, a little bit nicer little, UI. But they have the new Xbox 360 with the brand new Kinect that's out, which is this motion sensing thing where you don't need any controllers. Not every game is capable of it, of course. They also have the big selling right now, which is good for them, the Call of Duty. By the way, do you review video games ever? Do you look at this stuff?
I haven't played Call of Duty, but I know about the game.
Do you know, first of all, I can't believe the stock on Activision hasn't moved anymore, but okay. You know, do you know that the mission is to kill Castro?
No, that's fascinating.
I'm not kidding. I was horrified. I'm not saying whether or not Castro was good or bad or anything like that, but I was just... You know, how do you put on something to kill a living, you know, government official on a game?
Yeah, it's kind of astonishing. They're selling a lot of copies.
Oh, yes, they are. I played it. It's kind of cool. Now, but now we have all this going on with Microsoft. Their phone, the Microsofties, the guys that I know at Microsoft, are all excited about this phone.
So, you know, this has been a really interesting year for Microsoft, right? So you've had... huge success with Windows 7, which has sold very, very well. It's really become the dominant version of Windows on the desktop. They've actually gained some traction with Bing. If you now count their search deal with Yahoo, they're about a quarter of the U.S. search market. They're a long way behind Google, but they're now the number two player there. I mean, people are excited about Kinect. We'll see how it sells. Microsoft claims that they've... They expect to sell about 5 million units in the December quarter, which is an increase from a previous projection they made of like 3 million. So, you know, they think Kinect's going to be a big deal. And then you've got Windows Phone 7, which is their new OS. The last version, Windows Mobile OS 6, or 6.5, I guess is the last one, was widely derided. And, sales of Windows-based phones had dropped so much that they were down to, 2 or 3% of the market. I mean, they really weren't, they stopped being much of a player. Phone 7 is, has a kind of different metaphor. They've got these, like, tiles on the screen. It's a very visual, kind of a visually appealing way of using the phone. They've got support from a number of handset manufacturers that are making phones based on the OS. And then the question is going to be, can they get enough traction to compete? It's a very crowded marketplace. I mean, besides, we've talked about Apple and RIM, but you've got Android phones from a host of manufacturers that are selling like crazy. They're actually selling more Android phones than iPhones. It's a little bit of a tricky comparison because when you're talking about Android phones, you're talking about phones from Samsung and Motorola and HTC and a couple of other players. So into that, and by the way, coming some point soon will be new Palm WebOS phones from HP, and then you've got Nokia. So there's a lot of competition out there. The question is whether Microsoft and their partners can get enough traction and lure people to their phones. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, they got one bit of good news this week when Dell said that they were going to force all of their 20-some-odd thousand BlackBerry users to switch over to a Windows 7-based phone from Dell.
Mm-hmm.
Dell is doing this in part because, well, you know, you have to eat your own cooking, right?
Right.
Dell, if Dell employees are using BlackBerry, something is wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, on the other hand, they also are starting a business that basically will help people switch from BlackBerry phones to Dell phones.
Yeah, another slam on RAM.
Yeah, so, you know, and by the way, they also make, Dell makes both, Dell already was making Android phones too, so they'll allow their employees to use those, as long as they have Dell logos on them. That's their main issue. But the question is, can you get enough critical mass to get people to switch? And there are at least a half dozen mobile phone OSs out there. How many do we need?
Clearly
6 is probably, and there's actually, I guess if you really did the complete count, it would be more than 6. I don't think there's much room for more than 3.
Did you forget about Symbian, that fantastic system from Nokia?
Well, you know, you've got Symbian, and then you've got Mego, which is their kind of high-end OS that they've done in a kind of combination with Intel, and you've got some Linux-based phones. There's a lot of OSs out there, way too many. And in fact, if you're a software developer, you have a real decision to make. Can you develop your app on 7 or 8 or whatever the right number is platforms? I don't think you do. I think you have to figure out, well, I have to be on Android and I have to be on, on iPhone. What else do I need to do? And then you have to make a decision. Do I need to be on BlackBerry? Do I need to be on Nokia? Now, remember that Nokia, for all its troubles, while they continue to lose market share, still is the market share leader. They still sell more smartphones around the world than anybody else. Now, that's a little surprising if you happen to live in the United States, because they sell like next to no smartphones here.
Yeah, but
let's
start with this. Let's say there's dunce phones, let's say there's intelligent phones, and let's say there's smartphones, okay?
Uh-huh.
I don't think any of the Nokias really are at the level of smartphone like the iPhone, like the even the Torch or any of the Android systems. They're kind of like
they do have some highly capable high-end smartphones. Just they have no carrier support in the US. And they also have no clue on how to do consumer branding in the U.S. I mean, they still insist on calling their phones, you know, like the, you know, N90 or something. So they don't, you know, they don't really compete very well from in terms of trying to attract consumer attention. There's a sort of small band, probably, of, you know, Nokia loyalists. You can buy the phones unlocked here, but you can't buy them for the most part, with a few exceptions. You can't buy them through the carrier, so you end up buying them, you know, unsubsidized. You have to really want them badly.
Yeah, really badly.
But you know, again, they do have a much better position outside the U.S. than they do here. But nonetheless, they're a big player, but they're losing share. So, you know, developers have to make a decision, and it's becoming increasingly clear that when you are buying a smartphone, you know, you're buying it in part for its ability to run apps.
Right.
So you need apps to choose from.
Well, maybe they'll come out with a Nokia Sizzle or the Nokia Sex Machine or something like that, and maybe instead of the N95, which I own the N90, I think I own the N95, which is not the easiest thing to use, although it was cool when I got it for traveling. But lots going on in this. We'll have to see how this all pans out for the technology area. Obviously, we're seeing a lot of tension building up right now. Still a lot of bulls out there, clearly, and a lot of opportunity, it seems to me, for the increasing expansion of broadband and all that. But we'll see if Cisco does have that little effect on being like you said, the canary in the coal mine when it comes to at least a short-term top in the markets. And I think we also have to mention that Cisco's drop this time of about 16-17% was the worst I think they've ever had in recently had in the last several years. on an earnings announcement, and it was glum.
Yeah, I think it was the worst single day for them in a decade or more.
Really unbelievable. Eric Savitz from Barron's and Tech Trader Daily. You have to read all of the work that he does. Great information. He wrote about Microsoft, I believe, last week. He wrote about the LCDs. You would have known all about that. He's written about RIM and what's going on there. He writes about all the things that you need to know about when it comes to technology over at Barron's, either on the weekly or on the daily. Thanks, buddy. We'll see you soon.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye. That's going to wrap it up for today. I think that was pretty interesting, actually. A little bit longer than we anticipated at first, but I think that the fact is that we'll have to see. You have to check out this chart that we put on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes for this episode. And by the way, you have to make sure to check in weekly. We have a lot of analysis of different stocks. We talk about economics. We talk about some of the things that are going on, like, for example, the ridiculousness and backfiring now, boomeranging, if you will, of the QE2. Someone I heard recently said, will QE2 turn into Titanic 1? We'll see. But I think there's a lot of very angry countries out there for what we've done. And if we look at what's just happened recently in China with a 4.4% inflation rate and, kind of blaming it on us, I think there's some truth in that. I think that the movement of the dollar has caused a lot about that. We'll continue talking about that in the coming weeks. I also want to mention that over at DH Unplugged, each and every week on Tuesday or Wednesday, John Dvorak and I, well, we talk about just all sorts of things. Politics, we talk about markets, we talk about sometimes restaurants, but it's really interesting, I think. And what's more interesting is that each and every week we put some ideas that we have on some stocks that may do well, and those are on a Google spreadsheet, and they're always live and updated on the web. Google has a great way of invoking and bringing in the Google Finance data right to the spreadsheet, so that we can actually give you some information live about the returns and information about some of the stocks that we have that we've picked. Been a lot of winners in there, a couple of losers mixed in as well. Go check it out over at DH Unplugged. And until next week, I hope you have a profitable week. I look forward to seeing you then. And don't forget to tell a couple of friends about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.